on virya, on energy, it's cultivation, application, and meditation. I'm going to use as the kind of the foundation a Ajahn Sujito did probably like a week-long workshop at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. And this is sort of the program that he used. And so I'll take that as a jumping off point and incorporate some of his readings and how he's laid it out. I'll use his structure. And which is very, I think, very useful. So that we'll start the day, say the first day, with motivation. And maybe the first thing to recognize is that the factor of effort is something that is like in the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, requisites of enlightenment or wings to awakening. The energy comes up, energy and effort come up 9 times, which is the most of any of the factors. So that in those, say like in the 37 factors of enlightenment, requisites to enlightenment, comes up as in the Iddhipada, as virya. It comes up in the indriyas, virya indriya. It comes up in the factors of in the bhala, as virya. It comes up in the padanas, which are the 4 right exertions, so 4 right efforts. Comes up in the Eightfold Path. Comes up in the Bojangas, so that it's both an important and necessary quality if we're talking about our practice and our growth in practice. And Ajahn Sujito starts this with the aspect of motivation, and dividing that into 2 sections. One is the sense of urgency, which is called Sangveka, and the other is inspiration or Saddha. So those are 2 complementary factors of motivation. And I thought I would. I found an article of Ajahn Jeff's, which talks about that quite directly. Say the Buddhist teachings on Sangveka and Pasahada. Pasahada is a similar word, a bit different from Saddha, in that it's more of an emotional tone. Pasahada is sort of the emotional tone of inspiration or faith oriented. Saddha, I think, is a bit more inclusive in terms of both view as well as the sort of emotion. And he starts his article with a quote, short quote. A life-affirming Buddhism that teaches us to find happiness by opening to the richness of our everyday lives. That's the quote. So he begins his article. That's what we want. Or, so we're told, by the people who try to sell us a mainstreamline Buddhism. But is it what we need? And is it Buddhism? Think back for a moment on the story of the young Prince Siddhartha and his first encounters with aging, illness, death, and a wandering contemplative. It's one of the most accessible chapters in the Buddhist tradition, largely because of the direct, true-to-the-heart quality of the young prince's emotions. He saw aging, illness, and death as an absolute terror and pinned all his hopes on the contemplative forest life as his only escape. As Asvaghosa, the great Buddhist poet, depicts the story, the young prince had no lack of friends and family members who tried to talk him out of those perceptions. And Asvaghosa was wise enough to show their life-affirming advice in a very appealing light. Still, the prince realized that if he were to give in to their advice, he would be betraying his heart. Only by remaining true to his honest emotions was he able to embark on the path that led away from the ordinary values of his society and toward an unsurpassed awakening into the deathless. This is hardly a life-affirming story in the ordinary sense of the term, but it does affirm something more important than life, the truth of the heart when it aspires to a happiness absolutely pure. The power of this aspiration depends on two emotions, called in Pali, Sangvega and Pasada. Very few of us have heard of them, but they're the emotions most basic to the Buddhist tradition. Not only did they inspire the young prince in his quest for awakening, but even after he became the Buddha, he advised his followers to cultivate them on a daily basis. In fact, the way he handled these emotions is so distinctive that it may be one of the most important contributions his teachings have to offer to American culture today. Sangvega was what the young Prince Siddhartha felt on his first exposure to aging, illness, and death. It's a hard word to translate because it covers such a complex range. At least three clusters of feelings at once. The oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that come with realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. A chastening sense of our own complacency and foolishness in having let ourselves live so blindly. And an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. This is the cluster of feelings we've all experienced at one time or another in the process of growing up. But I don't know of a single English term that adequately covers all three. It would be useful to have such a term, and maybe that's reason enough for simply adopting the word Sangvega into our language. But more than providing a useful term, Buddhism offers an effective strategy for dealing with the feelings behind it. Feelings that our own culture finds threatening and handles very poorly. Ours, of course, is not the only culture threatened by feelings of Sangvega. In the Siddhartha story, the father's reaction to the young prince's discovery stands for the way most cultures try to deal with these feelings. He tried to convince the prince that his standards for happiness were impossibly high, at the same time trying to distract him with relationships and every sensual pleasure imaginable. Put it simply, the strategy was to get the prince to lower his aims and to find satisfaction in a happiness that was less than absolute and not especially pure. If the young prince were living in America today, the father would have other tools for dealing with the prince's dissatisfaction, but the basic strategy would be essentially the same. We can easily imagine him taking the prince to a religious counselor who would teach him to believe that God's creation is basically good, and not to focus on any aspects of life that would cast doubt on that belief. Or he might take him to a psychotherapist who would treat feelings of Sangvega as an inability to accept reality. If talking therapies didn't get results, the therapist would probably prescribe mood-altering drugs to dull the feeling out of the young man's system so that he could become a productive, well-adjusted member of society. If the father were really up on current trends, he might find a Dharma teacher who would counsel the prince to find happiness in life's little miraculous pleasures, a cup of tea, a walk in the woods, social activism, easing another person's pain. Never mind that these forms of happiness would still be cut short by aging, illness, and death, he would be told. The present moment is all we have, so we should try to appreciate the bittersweet opportunity of relishing but not holding on to brief joys as they pass. It's unlikely that the lion-hearted prince we know from the story would take to any of this well-meant advice. He'd see it as propaganda for a life of quiet desperation, asking him to be a traitor to his heart. But if he found no solace from these sources, where in our society would he go? Unlike the India of his time, we don't have any well-established, socially accepted alternatives to being economically productive members of society. Even our contemplative religious orders are prized for their ability to provide bread, honey, and wine for the marketplace. So the prince would probably find no alternative but to join the drifters and dropouts, the radicals and revolutionaries, the subsistence hunters and survivalists consigned to the social fringe. He'd discover many fine minds and sensitive spirits in these groups, but no accumulated body of proven and profound alternative wisdom to draw on. Someone might give him a book by Thoreau or Muir, but their writings would offer him no satisfactory analysis of aging, illness, and death, and no recommendations for how to go beyond them. And because there's hardly any safety net for people on the fringe, he'd find himself putting an inordinate amount of his energy into issues of basic survival, with little time or energy left over to find his own solution to the problem of Sangveka. He would end up disappearing, his Buddhahood aborted, perhaps in the Utah Canyon country, perhaps in a Yukon forest, without trace. Fortunately for us, however, the prince was born in a society that did provide support and respect for its dropouts. This was what gave him the opportunity to find a solution to the problem of Sangveka that did justice to the truths of his heart. The first step in that solution is symbolized in the Siddhartha story by the prince's reaction to the fourth person he saw on his travels outside of the palace, the wandering forest contemplative. The emotion he felt at this point is termed pasada, another complex set of feelings usually translated as clarity and serene confidence. It's what keeps Sangveka from turning into despair. In the prince's case, he gained a clear sense of his predicament and of the way out of it, leading to something beyond aging, illness, and death, at the same time feeling confident that the way would work. As the early Buddhist teachings freely admit, the predicament is that the cycle of birth, aging, and death is meaningless. They don't try to deny this fact, and so don't ask us to be dishonest with ourselves or to close our eyes to reality. As one teacher has put it, the Buddhist recognition of the reality of suffering, so important that suffering is honored as the first noble truth, is a gift in that it confirms our most sensitive and direct experience of things, an experience that many other traditions try to deny. From there, the early teachings ask us to become even more sensitive, to the point where we see that the true cause of suffering is not out there, in society or some outside being, but in here, in the craving present in each individual mind. They then confirm that there is an end to suffering, a release from the cycle, and they show the way to that release through developing noble qualities already latent in the mind to the point where they cast craving aside and open onto deathlessness. Thus the predicament has a practical solution, a solution within the powers of every human being. It's also a solution open to critical scrutiny and testing, an indication of how confident the Buddha was in the solution he found to the problem of Sangveka. This is one of the aspects of authentic Buddhism that most attracts people who are tired of being told that they should try to deny the insights that inspired their sense of Sangveka in the first place. In fact, early Buddhism is not only confident that it can handle feelings of Sangveka, but it's also one of the few religions that actively cultivates them to a radical extent. Its solution to the problems of life demands so much dedicated effort that only strong Sangveka will keep the practicing Buddhist from slipping back into his or her old ways. Hence the recommendation that all Buddhists, both men and women, lay or ordained, should reflect daily on the facts of aging, illness, separation, and death, to develop feelings of Sangveka, and on the power of one's own actions to take Samveka one step further to Pasada. For people whose sense of Samveka is so strong that they want to abandon any social ties that prevent them from following the path to the end of suffering, Buddhism offers both a long proven body of wisdom for them to draw from, as well as a safety net, the monastic sangha, an institution that enables them to leave lay society without having to waste time worrying about basic survival. For those who can't leave their social ties, Buddhist teaching offers a way to live in the world without being overcome by the world, following a life of generosity, virtue, and meditation to strengthen the noble qualities of the mind that will lead to the end of suffering. The symbiotic relationship designed for these two branches of the Buddhist parisa, or community, guarantees that each will benefit from contact with the other. The support of the laity guarantees that the monastics will not need to be overly concerned about food, clothing, and shelter. The gratitude that the monastics inevitably feel for the freely offered generosity of the laity helps to keep them from turning into misfits and misanthropes. At the same time, contact with the monastics helps the laity foster the proper perspective on life that nurtures the energy of Samveka and Pasada they need to keep from becoming dulled and numb by the materialistic propaganda of the mainstream economy. So the Buddhist attitude toward life cultivates Samveka, a clear acceptance of the meaninglessness of the cycle of birth, aging, and death, and develops it into Pasada, a confident path to the deathless. That path includes not only time-proven guidance, but also a social institution that nurtures it and keeps it alive. These are all things that our society desperately needs. It's a shame that, in our current efforts at mainstreaming Buddhism, there are aspects of the Buddhist tradition usually ignored. We keep forgetting that one source of Buddhism's strength is its ability to keep one foot out of the mainstream, and that the traditional metaphor for the practice is that it crosses over the stream to the further shore. My hope is that we will begin calling these things to mind and taking them to heart, so that in our drive to find a Buddhism that sells, we don't end up selling ourselves short. I think that was done for a tricycle or something. It might have been the prior to editing version. To the start the readings on, and continue the readings on, from the start the readings in the canon on Samveka. This is Jin Sujito. Starts with a quite usefully giving a sense of the cosmology of from a Buddhist perspective, and that's where he starts it off. So what's a nice kid like you doing in a place like this? A survey of samsara. Also, as I'm reading, as we go through the things, if people have questions as we're going along, feel free to sort of ask or put a hand up or make some sort of and try to attract my attention. Because if we leave it till the end, maybe it's getting swamped with information. So this is from the introduction to the Anguttara Nikaya, or an anthology of the Anguttara Nikaya, as by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he talks about these two different aspects of the teachings, that sort of there's a vertical teaching which is say the immediate present moment theme of the teaching, and then a horizontal aspect to the teachings, which is more extensive and carries over time. While this directly visible aspect of the Dhamma offers us personal confirmation of the psychological principle enshrined within the Four Noble Truths, it by no means exhausts the significance of those truths. The vertical view of the teaching must be completed by the horizontal view, for in their full range and depth, the Four Noble Truths go beyond mere psychological healing to offer us the blueprint for a comprehensive path to deliverance. They draw their meaning from a picture of the human situation far wider and deeper than that available to us by immediate observation. This is the picture that the Buddha discerned on the night of his enlightenment, when the mists of ignorance were dispelled and the light of wisdom could shine forth unobstructed. On that night, as he sat in profound meditation, the Buddha perceived human existence as unfolding within a succession of rebirths called samsara, the wandering on. Individual existence within samsara, he saw, is a process of becoming without discernible beginning, a chain of births and deaths linked together in an unbroken causal sequence. The cosmic process within which sentient life is nested is likewise beginningless, without a creator, without a final destination. He saw world systems arise, develop and dissolve, and then saw new world systems arise from the ruins of the old. The time scale of the process was staggering. Each world system endured for an aeon, the unit of cosmic computation, which would be measured in the billions of years. Subsequently, the Buddha taught that the sentient universe, spread out in boundless space and time, consists of a stratified hierarchy of realms among which living beings are constantly transmigrating. The early Buddhist texts envision a universe with three principal tiers subdivided into numerous planes. The lowest tier is the sense sphere realm, Kama Dhatu, so called because the driving force within this realm is sensual desire. The sense sphere realm contains 10 planes, the hells, the animal realm, the sphere of ghosts, shade-like spirits subject to tormenting desires, the human realm, and 6 sensuous heavens inhabited by beings called devas, gods who enjoy far greater happiness, beauty, power, and glory than we know in the human realm. Above the sense sphere realm is the form realm, Rupa Dhatu. Here the coarser types of matter are absent and sensual desire has largely abated. The realm is divided into 4 main tiers with several planes in each. The inhabitants of these planes are also devas, though to distinguish them from the gods of the sensuous heavens, they are often called brahmas. The lifespan of the various brahmic planes increase exponentially, and the prevailing mode of experience here is meditative rather than sensory. The brahmic planes, in fact, are the ontological counterparts of the jhanas, the meditative absorptions. Beyond the form realm lies an even more exalted sphere of existence called the formless realm, Arupa Dhatu. The beings in this realm consist solely of mind, without a physical basis, as matter is entirely absent here. The 4 planes that make up this realm, successively more subtle, are the ontological counterparts of the 4 formless meditations, after which they are named, the base of the infinity of space, the base of the infinity of consciousness, the base of nothingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. The texts often compress this elaborate cosmology into a simpler scheme of 5 destinations. The hells, the animal realm, the sphere of ghosts, the human realm, and the deva world, the last including all the numerous deva planes of the 3 realms. The first 3 are called the planes of misery, Apaya Bhumi, or the bad destinations, Dukkati. The human realm and the deva planes are collectively called the good destinations, Sukkati. For early Buddhism, the lower tentative aim for the follower of the Dhamma is to avoid a fall into the bad destinations and to win a fortunate rebirth in the good destinations. This itself is a difficult enough achievement, for those beings who are reborn as humans and devas are few compared to the vastly greater number who are reborn in the bad destinations. To secure a fortunate rebirth, it is essential to understand the causal principle that underlies the process of transmigration. For the process is not arbitrary, but is governed by an invariable and all-encompassing law. This law was another of the discoveries that the Buddha made on the night of his enlightenment, and throughout his ministry he repeatedly explained its mode of operation. The key factor that regulates the process of rebirth, the hidden spring behind the shifting kaleidoscope of living forms, is a force that the Buddha called karma. Though much mystification has been woven around the idea of karma in the West, for the Buddha there is nothing mysterious about the idea at all. The word karma means simply deed or action. But for the Buddha, karma is a particular type of action, intentional action, action springing from volition, jetana. Deeds become manifest through three doors or channels, outwardly through body and speech, and inwardly through the mind door, as thoughts, plans, desires, and emotions. The source from which all types of action issue is volition, and thus it is volition that imparts to action its ethically determinate quality. Sure. Yeah. That would be considered a peta realm. Because peta, I think, is actually widely. Oftentimes, all you hear about are these beings with big stomachs and thin throats. But peta is more widely used in to cover all types of different kinds of ghosts and ghost realms. So. Yeah. I was actually trying to think of that just now. Yeah, peta has some broader meaning. It's more. Yeah, because we do it in one of our chants the meal chants. That's the word peta is used, and it's basically meaning those who are deceased. Well, I mean, they're asuras are it's a more. I think the peta, like petas, are the more broader use, and asuras are tend to be, and they're not really that clearly distinguished. It's more in later literature that asuras tend to be talked about more. That the asuras are the sort of beings of power who are in conflict with the devas, or those in. Yes, and they fell because they got in quarrels, quarreling and fighting with the devas, and they almost made it. And then they got into an argument. These are.
So from that, a question about, you say, asada.
Yeah.
What's the meaning of the chanda?
Well, chanda is more like desire and. I meant to actually look it up this morning because I did. Go into the PTS dictionary and look up Pasada and see what its other cluster of, and I didn't do that. But the as I understand it, like chanda is more desire, motivation, whereas prasada is more the faith, confidence, and emotional tone of that confidence. So there's a clarity and confidence in terms of a mental state, and chanda is more like a motivation or a force that pushes you to do things. They're kind of close. Well, chanda, but except that chanda gets used in many different contexts. Because also, like, because it has to be qualified. Because you get kama chanda is the first hindrance, sensual desire. So you'd have to be something like dhamma chanda, that they say that sort of desire that arises out of dhamma, or the love for the dhamma, desire for the dhamma. This is a from the Anguttara Nikaya, from the Anguttara ones. Just as, O monks, in this Jambudipa, delightful parks, groves. Jambudipa is India. The Jambudipa, rose apple, the rose apple continent. Delightful parks, groves, landscapes, and lotus ponds are few, while rough hills and slopes, impassable rivers, and rugged mountains covered with stumps and thorns are many. So too, those beings are few who are reborn among human beings, while those who have been reborn in other realms are many. Those who are endowed with the noble eye of wisdom are few, while those who are confused and immersed in ignorance are many. Those who get to see the Tathagata and to hear his Dhamma and discipline are few, while those who fail to gain this chance are many. Those who understand the meaning and the Dhamma and who practice in accordance with the Dhamma are few, while those who fail to do so are many. Those who are stirred by things that are truly stirring are few, while those who are not so stirred are many. Those who properly strive are few, while those who do not properly strive are many. Those who gain concentration, which makes relinquishment its object, are few, while those who fail to gain such concentration are many. Those who obtain the exquisite taste of delicious food are few, while those who do not obtain such food, but subsist on scraps brought in a bowl, are many. Those who obtain the taste of the goal, the taste of the Dhamma, the taste of liberation are few, while those who fail to obtain such tastes are many. Therefore, monks, you should train yourselves thus. We will obtain the taste of the goal, the taste of the Dhamma, the taste of liberation. Thus should you train yourselves. This one is also from the Anguttara Nikaya, Anguttara 3's, Sutta number 76. Once the Venerable Ananda came to see the Blessed One and spoke to him thus. One speaks, Lord, of becoming. How does becoming take place? If, Ananda, there were no kamma ripening in the sense sphere realm, would there appear any sense sphere becoming? Surely not, Lord. Therefore, Ananda, kamma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture for the consciousness of beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving to become established in a lower realm. Thus there is re-becoming in the future. If, Ananda, there were no kamma ripening in the form realm, would there appear any form sphere becoming? Surely not, Lord. Therefore, Ananda, kamma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture for the consciousness of beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving to become established in an intermediate realm. Thus there is re-becoming in the future. If, Ananda, there were no kamma ripening in the formless realm, would there appear any formless sphere becoming? Surely not, Lord. Therefore, Ananda, kamma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture, for the consciousness of beings, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, to become established in a lofty realm. Thus there is re-becoming in the future. It is in this way, Ananda, that there is becoming. Continue on the theme of kamma. This is from Anguttara Sixes, Sutta number 63. And this is just a part of the sutta. It was said that kamma should be known, its conditioned origin and so forth should be known. Because of what was this said? It is volition, monks, that I declare to be kamma. Having willed, one performs an action by body, speech, or mind. And what, monks, is the conditioned origin of kamma? It is contact that is its conditioned origin. And what, monks, is the diversity of kamma? There is kamma leading to the hells, to the animal realm, to the sphere of ghosts, to the human world, and to the heavenly realms. And what, monks, is the outcome of kamma? Kamma, I declare, has a threefold outcome. In this life, in the next life, or in subsequent future lives. And what, monks, is the cessation of kamma? Through the cessation of contact, there is cessation of kamma. And it is this Noble Eightfold Path that is the way leading to the cessation of kamma, namely right view through to right concentration. If, monks, a noble disciple in such a way knows kamma, if in such a way he knows the conditioned origin, the diversity, the outcome, and the cessation of kamma, and the way leading to its cessation, he knows this penetrative holy life as the cessation of kamma. Because of this, it was said that kamma should be known, its conditioned origin, and so forth, should be known.
Well,
if you go, because you go into that, like into the dependent origination, pasa, so that contact which is conditioned by ignorance then goes into the whole realm of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And then, of course, the undermining of ignorance is with the cessation of ignorance, the cessation of mental forming, cessation of through the cessation of contact, cessation of desire, cessation of attachment and becoming, so a cessation of the whole cycle. So it's sort of like a catchword for the whole cycle. There, yeah. Because if that were the case, if all contact, it's the same as like in the previous readings on the five khandhas. It isn't the five khandhas that create suffering; it's the five khandhas and clinging aggregates. Right? That are conditioned by clinging and attachment. Okay. This next one is from the Machima 130, the Devadutta Sutta, the Divine Messengers. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetas Grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus." "Venerable sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, suppose there were two houses with doors, and a man with good sight, standing there between them, saw people going in and coming out, and passing to and fro. So too with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, I see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. I understand how beings pass on according to their actions thus. These worthy beings who were well conducted in body, speech, and mind, not revilers of noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right views in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. Or these worthy beings who were well conducted in body, speech, and mind, not revilers of noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right views in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared among human beings. But these worthy beings, who were ill conducted in body, speech, and mind, revilers of noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong views in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in the realm of ghosts. Or these worthy beings who were ill-conducted on the dissolution of the body after death have reappeared in the animal world. Or these worthy beings who were ill-conducted on the dissolution of the body after death have reappeared in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Now the warders of hell seize such a being by the arms and present him to King Yama." He's one who presides over the realm of death, saying, "Sire, this man has ill-treated his mother, ill-treated his father, ill-treated recluses, ill-treated Brahmins. He has had no respect for the elders of his clan. Let the king order his punishment." Then King Yama presses and questions and cross-questions him about the first divine messenger. "Good man, did you not see the first divine messenger to appear in the world?" He says, "I did not, venerable sir." Then King Yama says, "Good man, have you never seen in the world a young tender infant lying prone, fouled in his own excrement and urine?" He says, "I have, venerable sir." Then King Yama says, "Good man, did it never occur to you, an intelligent and mature man? I too am subject to birth. I am not exempt from birth. Surely I had better do good by body, speech, and mind." He says, "I was unable, venerable sir, I was negligent." Then King Yama says, "Good man, through negligence you have failed to do good by body, speech, and mind. Certainly they will deal with you according to your negligence. But this even evil action of yours was not done by your mother or your father, or by your brother or your sister, or by your friends and companions, or by your kinsmen and relatives, or by recluses and Brahmins, or by gods. This evil action was done by you yourself, and you yourself will experience its result." Then, after pressing and questioning and cross-questioning him about the first divine messenger, King Yama presses and questions and cross-questions him about the second divine messenger. "Good man, did you not see the second divine messenger to appear in the world?" He says, "I did not, venerable sir." Then King Yama says, "Good man, have you never seen in the world a man or a woman at 80, 90, or 100 years, aged, as crooked as a roof bracket, doubled up, supported by a walking stick, tottering, frail, youth gone, teeth broken, gray-haired, scanty-haired, bald, wrinkled, with limbs all blotchy?" He says, "I have, venerable sir." Then King Yama says, "Good man, did it never occur to you, an intelligent and mature man? I too am subject to aging. I am not exempt from aging. Surely I had better do good by body, speech, and mind." He says, "I was unable, venerable sir. I was negligent." Then King Yama says, "Good man, Through negligence you have failed to do good by body, speech and mind. Certainly they will deal with you according to your negligence. But this evil action of yours was not done by your mother, and so on, or by gods. This evil action was done by you yourself, and you yourself will experience its result. Then, after pressing and questioning and cross-questioning him about the second divine messenger, King Yama presses and questions and cross-questions him about the third divine messenger. Good man, did you not see the third divine messenger to appear in the world? He says, I did not, venerable sir. Then King Yama says, Good man, have you never seen in the world a man or a woman, afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill, lying foul in his own excrement and urine, lifted up by some, and set down by others? He says, I have, venerable sir. Then King Yama says, Good man, did it never occur to you, an intelligent and mature man? I too am subject to sickness. I am not exempt from sickness. Surely I had better do good by body, speech, and mind. He says, I was unable, venerable sir. I was negligent. Then King Yama says, Good man, through negligence you have failed to do good by body, speech, and mind. Certainly they will deal with you according to your negligence. But this evil action of yours was not done by your mother, and so on, or by gods. This evil action was done by you yourself, and you yourself will experience its result. Then after pressing and questioning and cross-questioning him about the third divine messenger, King Yama presses and questions and cross-questions him about the fourth divine messenger. Good man, did you not see the fourth divine messenger to appear in the world? He says, I did not, venerable sir. Then King Yama says, Good man, have you never seen in the world, when a robber culprit is caught, kings have many kinds of tortures inflicted on him, having him flogged with whips, and so on, a list of gruesome tortures that are done to criminals at that time. And having his head cut off with a sword, he says, I have, venerable sir. Then King Yama says, Good man, did it never occur to you, an intelligent and mature man, those who do evil actions have such tortures of various kinds inflicted on them, here and now. So what in the hereafter? Surely I had better do good by body, speech, and mind. He says, I was unable, venerable sir, I was negligent. Then King Yama says, Good man, through negligence you have failed to do good by body, speech, and mind. Certainly they will deal with you according to your negligence. But this evil action of yours was not done by your mother, and so on, or by gods. This evil action was done by you yourself, and you yourself will experience its result. Then, after pressing and questioning and cross-questioning him about the fourth divine messenger, King Yama presses and questions and cross-questions him about the fifth divine messenger. Good man, did you not see the fifth divine messenger to appear in the world? He says, I did not, venerable sir. Then King Yama says, Good man, have you never seen in the world a man or a woman? One day dead, 2 days dead, 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and oozing with matter. He says, I have, venerable sir. Then King Yama says, Good man, did it never occur to you, an intelligent and mature man? I too am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. Surely I had better do good by body, speech, and mind. He says, I was unable, venerable sir. I was negligent. Then King Yama says, Good man, through negligence you have failed to do good by body, speech, and mind. Certainly they will deal with you according to your negligence. But this evil action of yours was not done by your mother, and so on, or by gods. This evil action was done by you yourself, and you yourself will experience its result. And the next is all optional reading. Anybody who wants to know what the tortures in hell are, you can... if you... having difficulty with drowsiness at night, it's good bedtime reading. Really, seems the spine sort of gets going up pretty straight. It's probably a good place to leave it there.